Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today I'm delighted to have a guest, Lawrence Barrett. Lawrence is the author of A Jungian Approach to Coaching. He's the founder of Heresy Consulting. And previously, Lawrence trained as a coach with the Tavistock Institute in group work at the Institute of Group Analysis. And he holds certs in eco-psychology from the Pacifica Graduate Institute. And Lawrence has also done lots of leadership, change development in companies such as Prudential. And he says he wants to bring the magic of Jungian thinking to the world of coaching. So that's why we got Lawrence on. So Lawrence, we're here to discuss the magic of Jungian thinking. How are you doing today?
I'm not too bad, and all the better for talking about Jung in its magical way.
Good. Well, in the pre-conversation, as I said, I've read a bit of Jung. My main focus in psychoanalysis has been Freud, Klein, the object relations school. Then I got into the Lacanian work. So I'm a fairly novice to Jung. So you've got the job today to tell me all about Jung and kind of why it's important to coaching. So where do you begin? Where would you begin with that?
Where would you begin with that? I think I'll tell you what attracted me to Jung in the first place. I'll tell you a little story if I may. When I was a student, we discovered that we could get grants to do academic work. And I basically wanted to spend a summer rock climbing and smoking weed. So we thought, hey, let's get a grant and that'll pay us to do what we want to do. And we, under the thin pretense of doing something useful. And we got a grant to study cave paintings because a lot of famous prehistoric cave art in Europe is in outstanding rock climbing areas. And we went down to the Dordogne expecting to see basically a bunch of pictures on walls. And that really wasn't what I saw at all. The way cave art works, the way it kind of manifests is that it speaks through the cave walls. And there was something really sort of profound and magical just being in these caves, studying these paintings. And then weirdly, within a few months of that, by a strange synchronicity, I got given a book by two Jungian analysts, Sam Baring and Jules Cashford, called The Myth of the Goddess, which took a very Jungian view to prehistoric art and suggested, in fact, this idea, which for me was revolutionary at the time, that in some way there was a shared collective unconscious, something that held us together as human beings based on the fact that we were human and we have this kind of shared ancestry. And within that collective unconscious, there was a way of not accessing what people thought in the past, because that would be a bit of a delusion, but accessing some of the feelings that they were expressing, some of the things that those paintings were able to communicate of them to us. And that got me really excited about Jung. And then I sort of forgot a lot about it over the ensuing years. I mean, I did a lot of work in psychosocial systems and so on with a very Tavistock perspective. But I never really forgot that sort of Jungian aspect, that kind of mystery, if you like, that sort of unknowable feeling, as well as this kind of sort of the rational psychology, this sense of the magical that came with those cave paintings. And then in my last corporate role and over the course of the last 10 years at Heresy, what I've really been doing is trying to take Jungian theory and increasingly test how it can be applied within the corporate world. And particularly, I think, how we can use it to bring back a little bit of soul, a little bit of magic, something that is unknown in a world that typically wants things to be known and finalized and nailed down.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. I talk a lot in my work about kind of the disenchanted world we live in, and modernity is very disenchanted and refer to soul a lot, and also faith, transcendence and things. So how do you bring Jungian thinking into the workplace? Give us some examples or some practicals.
Well, I think you talk a bit about soul there, and I like soul. I think soul's a really good word. And when I first started doing this sort of work, I was a bit leery about using the word soul, because you think, well, you know, how's this going to land? It all sounds a bit, you know, if I may say, Californian. But as we started to talk about soul, as we started to look at it in a bit more detail, people kind of gravitated around that. There was a sort of recognition that within organizational life, there was a feeling, there were symbols, there were ideas that held people together that couldn't be rationally explained. There was a sense of belonging, there was team. It wasn't all sort of dysfunction and productivity and outcomes. For some organizations, there was a sense of belief, if you like, in the work they did together, a sense of feeling, a sense of soul in that sense, in the work. And all that was needed really was for somebody, a consultant probably, or a leader perhaps, to say, yeah, it's okay to feel that. And not everything has to be rational, not everything has to be sort of cold. Some things can be felt. And I'm reminded of a really good definition that James Hillman raised in Revisiting Psychology, where he described soul like this. He said that the rational mind is effectively cold and dead. There's nothing exciting about it. It's rational. It helps us send people to the moon, but it isn't in and of itself magical. It doesn't engage us. The unconscious mind is effectively psychotic and insane. And it draws us into this crazy vortex of madness and intuition and imagination, all of which is fine, but none of which really helps us live. Soul work is the work in between, where we somehow have to be able to take the inspirations and the feelings and the emotions that drive us, that give us energy, and we have to turn them into real things in the real world. And so for me, a lot of business work in that sense is, how do we help people not simply, I don't know, create these kind of stock visions or financial sets of targets, but how do we help people engage with the fact that they're doing something worth doing? That they're working with people they like, that they love, that they feel inspired by, and recognize that both of those things matter if you're in organizational life. You have to make money, but you can also do
that.
It feels good.
So in my analytic network coaching course and in my books, I talk about depth analysis and soul guide coaching, and I explore soul guide coaching, and I make the links to I think that coaching is not it's kind of new, and it's not new. Like it's a new form of kind of a therapeutic endeavor, which has been going on since the shamans, since kind of a mystic, since kind of I draw genealogy of coaching, and I link it back to kind of a spiritual friendship and this work, you know. But I don't use Jung. So what does Jung bring differently, or how does it help on that journey? I can see that our work's aligned here, but how does the Jungian piece help?
Well, I mean, firstly, I'm totally with you on that. I think that there is, it's like a continuum with, you know, highly specialized psychotherapy on one end and friendship on the other, and somewhere in between are all of the other conversations that we sort of have. And I think it is ancient, exactly as you say, you know, we're made to converse. So why do I think Jung matters? I think one of the things that Jung focused a lot on is this idea of symbol and the symbolic attitude. So within the Jungian frame, symbol isn't a sign. It's not a thing that we can interpret. We can't make a clear cut link between this particular image and that meaning. Symbol carries multiple ideas. It carries things that can't be expressed. It's indefinable in and of itself. So Freud apocryphally said, you know, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And I think to a Jungian, that's never true. The cigar can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people in a lot of different places. It always means something. It might not be significant, but it is important. It is there. And I think from a Jungian point of view, what we are trying to do is use symbol as a way of encouraging people to express things that can't necessarily be expressed in any other terms, things that are emotional, that are felt, and then using that kind of surfacing power of symbol to come up with things that are kind of more rational and can be worked with. So, for example, you know, simple technique. I'm quite big on collage. Sometimes with groups, I work with collage quite a lot, because I think if you allow people to just say, okay, you know, what does it feel like to work in this organization? Draw me a picture. Then many people won't want to do that because they're worried about the quality of their art. You know, get people to stick paintings together with out of magazines, and actually, you come up with some quite funny stuff, some crazy stuff, some interesting, and some real deep realizations of what's actually happening in the organization. And the magic in itself doesn't sit in the collage. The collage is like a, it's like a vehicle, like a vector to allow the conversation to happen. The conversation's what really matters. You know, when you actually sit down and go, so what did we come up with? What does it feel like to be in this group? But the symbol allows you to kind of bridge that gap, if you like, between what is unknown, the unknowable, and the reality of what we have to do with things. In existing in the world, the rational mind.
Yeah.
And Jung's focus on symbolic is crucial, I think, for that.
Yeah. It's interesting because there's so many different lenses to look at this. You know, I mean, like Lacan's imaginary, symbolic, and real registers. They have different takes on this. And do you think that Jung is? Do you classify Jung in your mind as a psychoanalyst or a psychologist, or doesn't it matter?
Well, I mean, from a Jungian point of view, psychoanalytic would be very Freudian, and I think there are some significant differences between him and Jung, which make a difference. But I think, I mean, Jung was a psychiatrist and a psychologist and a student of humanity in a way. You know, in some ways, you could describe him as an artist or a historian. He was a pretty extraordinary man. I think his real skill, however we whatever we call it, is being able to make sense of the things that make us human, which include both the rational mind, the ego, and this kind of elusive, sort of magical, what in the Jungian world we call numinous states, which are states of feeling. And recognizing that in bringing those two together, that's where we get the real engagement. That's where we become more fully human. That's where we feel our potential. Because we can use our intuition, we can unashamedly acknowledge the kind of magic and fear and emotions that drive us, but at the same time, we can do something with it. We can actually make choices, conscious choices. And that's where Jung was really, really focusing. It is worth saying, actually, there's an interesting difference between Jung and Freud's work that I think many people miss, which is what we describe in the Jungian world as the teleology of the psyche, which is the psyche's purposive. So, you know, many, and I think this is a misinterpretation of psychoanalytic thought, but a view that many psychoanalysts would have is that the unconscious is this kind of dead space that things settle into, having happened to you. And to return to that is then to provide the opportunity to re-heal the psyche by returning to this kind of sediment on the bottom of the lake. A Jungian view would be that psyche is always moving. It's always shifting. Yesterday is as important as 6 years ago, as 20 years ago. You know, memory is an illusion in a way. We remember what we need to remember based on the present. And if we think about it like that, the question from a Jungian point of view would be, so why are we talking about this now rather than, you know, talking about childhood? And so what presents now becomes incredibly important. And that for me is a really useful thing with coaching, because it allows you as a coach to work with some quite sort of deep, profound memories, not necessarily personal ones, but also of the culture of the that seem to be more archetypal. We can work with those ideas, but work with them not as an unpicking of the past, but as a reframing of the present, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. I mean, I think you're, The idea of the unconscious is this static. I mean, I critique a lot the when people put up a diagram of the iceberg with the ego on top and the superego down the edge, and it's a very dated understanding of the unconscious. It's much more relational. I mean, Lacan puts it between people, not even in people. There's different kind of takes, but I think this dynamism is interesting. I mean, some of the key thoughts on and critiques of Jung is the universalism of archetypes. That's a strength. It's also a critique. Sort of people say that this that's a dated way of understanding kind of human beings. What's your kind of thoughts on that?
Well, the trouble with archetypes is that there's a lot of distortion about this. And even inside the Jungian world, there's a lot of debate about how an archetype can be defined and what an archetype is. The idea that an archetype is a sign, in other words, we have a warrior, mm-hmm. we have a great mother, that's a bit of a, it's very misleading in the sense that A, it's not what Jung talks about. It's not a Jungian archetype. But it's also a kind of necessary conceit. If you want to talk about archetypes as undefinable energies, which is how Jung would have described them, at some point we do have to try and give them a frame, a way of fitting them together. So you have this like great mother idea, for example, but it's not an archetype. It would be a series of symbols that we might use to collectively understand an idea that is in any other way unknowable. So from a my understanding of Jung's work, how I interpret it, how I think about it, is that archetypes are collections of energy that have roots in the physical, in the phylogenetic sort of origins of humanity, because we have the bodies we have, because we are built in the way we're built. There are ways in which we can perform, if that makes sense, physically. And what that creates [S2] Yeah. [S1] Is a psychology. And the archetype in that sense has a psychological pole and a physical pole, but it's fundamentally unknown. And then over time, ideas have formed around that, which we attach energy to, which have a sort of magic to it. And culturally, then they assume forms, and culturally, those then assume personal forms. And so I don't like the idea of archetype in that sense, because I think it makes it too concrete. I prefer to use the word archetypal, and I'm being slightly semantic here, but you know what I mean. Having studied the canon,
I think it's important. I know one of the things which took me away from Jung was the way people use archetypes in a kind of a static way, and they you know, it's a new, you're a category, you're kind of a warrior, this or you're that, and people trying to fit kind of a human behavior into these kind of 12 brackets or whatever kind of archetypes there are. I mean, that's one of the, yeah, like you say, I think that's a misuse of
well, that drives me crazy. I mean, and you mentioned the 12. I mean, there is a sort of thing around 12 archetypes. It's simply not true. I mean, initiation is an archetype. Death is an archetype. Evil is an archetype. There are many different ways of thinking about archetypal forms. Because really what you're talking about when you talk about archetypal is kind of primal energy, something which speaks to us on a really primal, raw level, around which we then cluster ideas, which, you know, including our cultures, which we can... Yeah. So for me, archetypal simply means high energy in a way, I guess. That's probably the simplest way of putting it.
But would you say that Jung, I mean, there's two poles in my mind around Jung, around how he perhaps can be differentiated from other kind of psychoanalytic thinking. And one is at one level he does individuation, which is kind of very much about finding yourself as an individual. And at the other, there's this collective unconscious. And like my thinking is there is something kind of powerful around kind of the social, the collective, which Jung points to, which is kind of in many other forms of psychology, particularly in the West, is very individualized.
Yeah.
And Jung does bring something particular there. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, because individuation is often seen as if you like, confused with individualism. And I think Jung's perspective, again, you know, there is some debate about this, but how I would see Jung's perspective is that it is about how we find ourselves within the collective. It's an and question, not an either or.
Right.
So if we imagine, you know, as kids, as babies, pre-adolescents, our primary focus is all about finding ourselves, building our ego strength. It's all individual, has to be. And then we slowly move towards the adult state through adolescence and later childhood, which is around other. So how do we fit in? You know, how do we become a man? How do we become a woman? How do we become whatever we choose to be within the society within which we choose to be? How do we become an accountant? But then individuation suggests in the later part of life, it becomes much more about how I make choices about how I show up within the society that I'm working in, So it's a very adult recognition that, yeah, I have choices, but also I have responsibilities. I have roles. I have a society that I operate in. And both have to be balanced. Both have to be worked through in a way which is conscious. And so it is particularly important for leadership, because you get this sort of sense with leaders of, I have to lead in this way because that is how leadership works, which is how most business schools teach leadership. And I think it's really, really good for pre-midlife kind of early leadership work. The really difficult challenge that most leaders face as they move into the big jobs, the C-suite jobs, is not how I fit into a particular tick box of leadership. It's how do I take up leadership in a way that feels right to me, that feels integrated. Because many of those leaders are dealing with problems that can't be easily defined. They're not generic. They're quite specific to the organization. They're quite specific to the leader. They're also unsolvable in the sense that, you know, one of the hard realities of leadership at that level is whatever decision you make, there's a good chance it's going to be wrong. And there's a good chance you won't know about it for years, if ever. Because you're in essence groping in the dark. There's no checklist. And so what Jung's individuation allows us to come to terms with is by looking into yourself, by understanding how you are, and building a better sense of how the environment around you is and how others are, you can make better choices about how you show up. So for individuation for me is about the bridging of the individual and the collective in that sense. They often refer to the ego self axis, which is the line between the rational self and the potentiality of everything, of the whole.
And the collective unconscious, that's very thrown out as young year and kind of some people love it, some people hate it. It's very Marmite. What do you think about kind of that, the work, and what does that kind of how does that inform your thinking in organizations? And
well, I mean, we've grown up with this sort of idea. I mean, I say we, all of us have grown up with this very defined Cartesian idea that we're individual, and this is a kind of belief system. But what's interesting is that as we look at developments in neuroscience, particularly work people like Yuri Hassan, we're starting to realize that actually we're not individual, that thought may not be an individual act. With something like neural entrainment, neural coupling, we're starting to realize that I think that there is a kind of magical, indefinable quality to thought, which makes it not me and not you, but us. We have our own individual components, but there is also a we possession element of thought, which to me explains things like projective identification, which many psychologists would consider to be a sort of fantasy of psychoanalysts. But the reality, you know, as we start to look at reality of neurobiological research, I think we're starting to see thought in a much more magical way. And when we start to look at it like that, the collective unconscious suddenly becomes feasible. It's not simply a phenomenology. I mean, if we look at human history, we can see the collective unconscious starting to arise in our icons and our myths and all of that other good stuff, which is what Jung based his thinking on, his observations on. I think as we start to look at the way psychology is emerging, it's becoming a lot more probable that actually there is a collective psychology that binds us together, which has its roots in our histories and our ancestry and our physical locations, our cultures, our landscape, our worlds. And Jungian thinking sees us as part of a collective that is much more than human. In fact, it's also into the natural world. Jungian thinking is quite influential in eco-psychology in this basis. And I think that's fascinating because it's an experience that I feel. It's a phenomenology that I would say shows up in, you know, myth and archaeology and anthropology, but increasingly it's also arising in neurobiology as a strong possibility. So makes sense to me.
And you know, there's always been peripheral thinkers. I mean, Gordon Lawrence, I don't know if you know his work or read his work. He started Social Dream in Matrixes, and that's very much about kind of dreams are not individuals, they're kind of collective dreams. And he talks about thoughts seeking a thinker, which I think is a lovely phrase, you know, that the thoughts are kind of floating around and kind of seeking someone to think them, which I think speaks in a similar way to that kind of collective kind of notion. You mentioned then eco-psychology and Jung's work, and that's very interesting to me. I mean, in the Ecolegium Institute, we're very big on kind of the environment and trying to understand kind of we've had some Indigenous and First Nations speakers working with us. I'm going to do some more there. What's tell me something about eco-psychology from the work you've done. I'd be interested to hear kind of what's happening in your world and how Jung kind of overlaps with that.
But eco-psychology, as you know, is such an evolving discipline. My take on it is that it's the most important aspect of eco-psychology is to start to appreciate and understand ourselves in the world, the way the world changes us, the way we change the world. It's that kind of overlap that that doesn't put us aside from the world. The world is not something for us to use. Instead, the world is a co-creation, if you like. We are part of something which influences us and shapes us. It is in that sense collective, it's archetypal. And how I think that works practically, and everyone has different practices on this, but my principal focus from an eco-psychological point of view is noticing. Back a bit to this idea of symbolic attitude and noticing symbol. I think if we spend a little bit more time noticing what was going on in the world around us, let's say at a larger, more environmental level, sort of literally noticing how the weather's changing, noticing how we fit into different geographical settings, noticing eco-psychology, but also things like psychogeography, how the buildings change us and shape us. How do we feel about our environment? Yeah. And then bringing that down even closer to how do we then notice what's happening in the rooms we're in the meetings we're in? As I sort of often say to leaders in, you know, that I'm working with, the person on the other side of the table might not be a dick. You might be making them a dick by the way you're behaving. And so therefore, are we noticing what is happening in the meetings? What is happening in the environment, how the environment might change and shape us. And it also then allows us to start thinking more about, let's say, animal intelligence and the way we interact with other species on the planet. We've had this crazy Cartesian view that animals are non-rational, and that's clearly not true. And research is clearly proving that one to be a very narcissistic human myth. So how does that shape how we might view our use of other species and the way we work with them? So all of these become quite difficult questions, but I think it comes back to this very simple idea of noticing. Do you notice what's going on around you? Because in my experience, most people don't.
Yeah. No, we're getting worse and worse at noticing, except what's going on in front of the screen, in front of our eyes, our iPhones and things. It's interesting. If you walk the streets these days, there's so many people kind of just almost lost the idea that there's kind of other people around them. They're just kind of in their own bubble and thought bubble or phone bubble. It's that idea of noticing even the kind of the, like say, the building and the kind of psychogeography around you is becoming very diminished, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. When I worked in the city, I used to go into coffee shops. And one of the things that I noticed was that the people working there were treated as though they were, machines, you know, vending machines. People would come in, they'd order a coffee with no kind of facial expression, no sense of connection. And again, we know clinically, we know from people like Edtronic and so on, that sort of thing is profoundly disturbing. You know, it's damaging to the human soul. It's damaging to the psyche, and it was kind of norm, and that sort of upset me a little bit. And then I started working a lot harder to create connections with people, just talking to them about their morning, their day, and just having conversations. And it was quite interesting at first because a lot of people were quite sort of reluctant, almost like, "What the hell is this guy coming in here talking to me? Why? None of my other customers do. Why are you?" But what was fascinating was over the course of about 2 or 3 years, I started getting free stuff. To the point that I didn't pay for lunch anymore or coffee for a period of about 2 years. which was nice. It was a bonus. But it came out really of this whole idea of once you people start connecting as human beings, once you start noticing them and you can build this relationship, people like that. People are grateful for it because, you know, generally in our lives, we don't get that very often. Certainly we don't get it in organizations. And I often give this as a little challenge in a way to leadership programs that I run, you know, go away and get free stuff. And if you can't do that, let's have another chat about your capacity to build relationships.
Yeah. And of course that's very culturally embedded in different places. I mean, in Galway, on the west of Ireland here, the idea of not having a chat to somebody is anathema. Everybody kind of it's a very different kind of experience, which is beautiful, actually. It's really kind of one of the real positives of living here, apart from the nature. Jungian and thinking, and I'm a critical theorist, and I'm quite political, and think about psychosocial issues a lot. You've seen me post on LinkedIn and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where does Jung fit into kind of ethics? I mean, there's a whole kind of Nazi thing which kind of people throw at Jung and stuff. Yeah. But where does kind of a Jungian? I don't see much Jungian. I think you're a bit of an exception. You do comment kind of on social issues, but generally, I don't see Jungian thinkers in kind of this political psychosocial sphere. Am I missing it, or is it there, or what's your kind of thoughts on all that?
That's a really complex one. I mean, you mentioned Jung's connections with Nazi Germany. That's a source of a lot of controversy and is widely misunderstood. I think Jung made some naive errors on that. He was also incredibly critical of Nazi Germany. Jung was very critical of ideologies. He's very critical of Marxism, for example, which is interesting for me as a Marxist. That would have put off a few listeners. But I think Jung was a man of his time. I mean, he had a profound observation of human history, but he also was, a wealthy middle class Swiss gentleman, which coloured a lot of how he was thinking. I think, you know, once we get beyond that and start to look more at his ideas, I think they become very socially applicable. And there are people doing this. I mean, Andrew Samuels, for one, Renos Papadopoulos, are very much engaged with Jungian world as a piece of social activism. Jungian theory is a piece of social activism. And I think it's possible to do that. I think it's a shame that it hasn't been more taken up. One of the things that I find very sad, which is why I'm doing the work I'm doing, is that Jungian thinking hasn't permeated organizations much more because, you know, as you know, in our world, so many of us work in organizations, so many of us are part of the industrial complex, that actually there is an opportunity to significantly extend the way we can sort of build soul, we can build more kind of integrated human interactions within that environment and really change the world in that sense. So activism for me is not simply social, it's also organizational. And I do think the Jungian world there definitely lets itself down. I don't think it extends much at all into the places it could be in. My supervisor's very, this is one of the things she's driving a great deal. She's quite a well-known Jungian, and she always says to me that, you know, she can touch, I don't know, sort of 20, 30 people a week. But with developing coaches and developing organizations, we can be touching thousands.
There is potential for that. I mean, I was president of the International Society for the Psychoanalytic Study of Organizations, ISPSO, and we currently have a Jungian president, Claudia Nagel from Germany. So there's two or three, there's a few Jungians coming in. I mean, it's predominantly kind of Tavistock Institute kind of background, you know, sort of the object relations background. But there is some movement there. So that is interesting. I think there's a lot more room for that. And I'm 100% about bringing the soul back and making the connections to the environment. So there's a lot of overlap there, Lawrence. It's been really lovely talking to you. We're coming towards the end of the podcast. I asked my guests a question at the end, two questions. One is, from your work and your life experience, What can you say about what it means to live a good life and what it takes to create the good society? So just any thoughts from your, from this discussion or from your...
Yeah, definitely. I think the answer is the same for both questions for me. I think it's around noticing. I think if we're able to notice ourselves and notice others, we can make better choices, and we can make better choices in our relationships with other people. We can help other people make better choices. But to do that, we've got to notice more. We have to pay attention, I think. And that's something we've lost a lot of.
That's very, very useful. I totally agree. Lawrence, it's been really lovely talking to you. Thank you for your sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
And your ideas. Go well. Thank you. Edgy Ideas is sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We run webinars, we have a community of practice, we run advanced coaching courses. To find out more, go to ecoleadershipinstitute.org or contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com.